Coach, I know you're trying to figure this all out on your own. You're investing in your own learning on your own time because you want to show up for your teachers in the best way possible. Building your coaching program is a huge challenge, and it's even more difficult when you're asked to know about literacy practices and how to support them. That's why I created the Confident Literacy Coach. This self-paced course gives you the knowledge, strategies, processes, and downloadable tools that you need to be confident in your coaching work every single day. The new update to the reading and writing modules includes information about literacy that will help you grow your school's practices and grow your students into skilled readers and writers. Check it out at confidentliteracycoach.com and stop reinventing the wheel. Have you felt like you've provided all the PD, you've facilitated all the PLCs, and you've had all the conversations, but your teachers are still stuck? If your teachers are resistant to instructional change or having trouble implementing new things, it might look something like this. They're still using outdated practices that we know don't work. They fight every PLC to cling to their favorite lessons or strategies. You see evidence of poor instructional methods everywhere despite having provided tons of PD in better practices. And kids aren't learning and the same kids are at the bottom of the data chart every single time. Does this sound familiar? To literacy coaches who are committed to helping students grow as readers and writers, this is especially frustrating. That's why I created a free webinar for literacy coaches, but really any coach can value from it. It's all about helping teachers embrace new practices and try out something new, even when they're not excited about it. We'll learn why teachers resist change, how to help teachers feel secure and ready to try something new, and my favorite strategies and methods to encourage choice while expecting and holding them accountable for trying new things. I'm so excited to share this information with you that I created a free download that you'll get when you grab the free pre-recorded webinar at buzzingwithmissb.com/shift. Grab it today. It's totally free and it will make such a difference in your coaching. Welcome to Instructional Coaching with Miss B, where we believe that every teacher deserves a coach and every coach does too. I'm Chrissy Beltran, an elementary teacher who became a coach, and I had to create my own coaching program that worked. Now I teach coaches how to design their coaching programs, build a school-wide action plan, and use differentiated strategies to support teachers. Plus, I've got a special spot in my heart for literacy coaches. Now let's dig into the episode. Hey, Coach, and welcome to episode 190 of Instructional Coaching with Miss B. Today, the episode is all about supporting highly effective practices in math with my guest, Kristen Acosta. Before we get started, I wanted to remind you a little bit of the series that we've been working on, which is Best Practices in Schools. So the last several episodes have been about the kinds of practices that we want to make sure that we are growing in our schools to make sure that our kids are really learning. So we talked a little bit about what some successful schools are doing, what rigor looks like, how we can support highly effective strategies in literacy with SOR, and why all coaches are needing literacy content knowledge about reading and writing because we need to be reading and writing across the curriculum. So those are the last episodes that started back in episode 186. If you want to go back and catch the beginning of this series, this is the last episode in the Best Practices in Schools series. So before we get started, I wanted to tell you about a free download that will help you do some of the work that we're going to talk about today. It's my Digging Into Data Guide. This guide will help you look at data with your teachers to support your planning. And then from there, you can use the PLC planning forms and agenda to actually plan together to implement some of the things that you talked about when you looked at your data. So definitely check out those links. If you go to buzzingwithmissb.com/episode190, you can access the links to those because that is the link for the show notes. buzzingwithmissb.com/episode190. So you can grab the show notes there. You can find out a little bit more about Kristen. You can see some of the highlights of our conversation, and you can also grab some information that would be helpful for you as you're trying to implement this at your school. Grab the free download, the Digging Into Data Guide, and you'll be able to do all of these things with your teachers. We are going to welcome Kristen to the podcast, and I am so excited to have her as a guest today. So welcome, Kristen, to the podcast today.
Thank you, Chrissy. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for the invite.
Oh, definitely. Well, I would love for you to introduce yourself to our listeners. So as a quick way to introduce yourself, I want to hear about three things, okay? I'm going to want to hear about who do you help and how do you spend most of your time and energy at work? And what is your favorite TV show of all time? Those are the three things that I'm going to want to hear.
Okay. So who do I help? Okay, so you could kind of say I've been an educator, specifically a math educator, for over 25 years. Kind of currently, I started off with middle school, taught middle school math for about 14 years. I was a district math coach for a few years, and then I transitioned into becoming a sixth grade elementary teacher currently, that I've been doing for about 7 or 8 years or so. So by day I'm a teacher, but I don't want to say by night, but I'm also, that's why I describe myself as a math educator, because it encompasses so much more. I go out and do trainings. I speak at conferences. I'm an author. I've written a book. So I kind of like a hodgepodge of things. You know, I don't like to limit myself to saying just a teacher, because that word just is so belittling yes, sometimes. Right. So I kind of call myself a math educator because I wear a lot of hats, and depending on, you know, time of day and sometimes the week or whatever. So that's pretty much what I do. Math is my jam. Math is what I do. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. All right. And what is your favorite TV show of all time?
Can I say how much I love this question? Okay. So my favorite TV show, and I was, you know, this was marinating with me, but I have to say 30 Rock.
Oh, that's a good one.
Because Tina Fey, I always played this game, like, who, if they made a movie about your life, who would play you? And I said, mm-hmm. Tina Fey has got my sense of humor. She is so spot on. She's funny, but she's like smart funny, you know, mm-hmm. and that was a TV show that resonated with me, because there were so many jokes going practically like a mile a minute. It was, mm-hmm.
Yes.
Fabulous. And then the whole premise was just funny, and you had to really pay attention because the jokes were coming at you in all different ways or whatever. So it's one. 30 Rock for sure is one of my all time faves.
That's a great one. It's worth rewatching. There's lots of, like you said, there's so many things going on. You can always find something new to appreciate.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, just cause I'm a big Tina Fey fan. Love awesome. Her. Love her sense of humor. And like I said, smart, funny kind of thing. I like that. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you for sharing about that.
Yeah.
I'm sure somebody's going to add that to their watch list if they don't already have it. And I would love to dig in to kind of an overview of what it is that we're trying to do when we're teaching math in pre-K through 12 schools. So what exactly are we trying to build in students by the time they leave our school?
I think a couple of things. Some educators out there will say, oh, we want them to get a joy of math. And I think that's a pretty far reaching goal. So my two answers for that are going to be, I want them to obtain, of course, number sense. And I think for especially K through, I'm going to say even extended to 8, just figuring out, how do numbers work? How are they related? There's interconnectedness. Like, what is that? That's, I think, one of our, you know, goals as educators for sure. The other goal is kind of like a subjective, again, kind of finding the joy in math. And I'm not saying that, you know, everybody needs to love it as much as I do. But what I do want is them to enjoy it with the experiences that I put together. Mm-hmm. I want them to be able to apply the math that they're learning, not necessarily using the textbook page 47, because I think that kills the joy of math. I think it dulls it down. So by certain experiences, whether it be games, whether it be, you know, different types of routines, you know, just have an appreciation for math. You know, I basically just don't want them walking away hating it, because the reason why kids think they are bad at math, and I'm putting full quotes on that, everybody's a math person. However, do they have negative feelings because of certain experiences? I'm a true believer. I think that's what really happened. And I think usually those kids, or even some adults that say, oh, I'm bad at math, can tell you a story, whether, oh, in second grade, this happened, in third grade, this happened, and so on. So I'm not saying that everybody has to be happy-go-lucky and, you know, hey, we all love math. Yes, we're all, but just have an appreciation for it, and kind of embrace it. And I mean, no matter what, we do live in mathematized worlds. We do use it. In some math, we're going to use more than others. Mm-hmm. However, just have an appreciation for it. Not necessarily a love, just an appreciation for it. So I think that would be our best two bets, number sense and an appreciation for math.
Yeah, I think those are really important. Number sense is enormous because it's literally in every part of your day. If you can understand mm-hmm. how numbers work and how they relate and how mm-hmm. these math concepts are relevant, it's you can find it everywhere. Like going to, it's an obvious, everybody uses it, but going to the grocery store, I do know people who cannot do the mental math to just estimate what's in the cart, mm-hmm. you know? And that is something that, I mean, we failed if we had kids doing long division with like memorizing all these, you know, acronyms, but not understanding how to, you know, manipulate some numbers to figure out how to add them up, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know? I 100% agree. I'll tell you very quick story of how this applies. And I'm going to date myself here. I was in Circuit City. Can you believe it? I said Circuit City when Circuit Cities were going out of business. So of course they had mm-hmm. these ginormous sales. And this is kind of ironic. I was buying DVDs. I think I was buying the 30 Rock DVD. So see how it comes full circle.
Yeah.
So, and it, you know, the sticker price said, I think it was like 40% off. And yeah, I don't remember the exact percent or whatever. So I get up there and they say, it's going to be, I forget what the price was going to be. And I was going, and I'm sitting there doing my math and there's a line of people behind me. I'm like, no, that's not right. And the cashier looks at me like, well, no, that's what the price says. And I said, no, that's right. So I pull out, not a calculator, but we all have our cell phones and stuff. So and I hear the people behind me. Oh, she's pulling out the calculator. Oh, she's and I'm like, yeah, because I know how to do the math for this or whatever. So I'm showing the cashier, look, 40% of whatever the price is supposed mm-hmm. to be this, which is like at least a couple of bucks lower than what they were quoting me. So they're like, okay, that's fine. And they put in a price. And then I look at the price again and it said it was even like, they gave me a percentage higher than 40%. Oh. They give me like 50%. Now that's at the time I wasn't going to complain. I'm like, okay, that's the price you want to give me, but I'm just trying to show you the math, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's in, you know, especially in consumer, mm-hmm. I want to make sure that your math is correct or whatever. So, but I remember the comments behind the line. Oh, she's taking out her calculator. Oh, she's doing. Yeah, I am. That's really and you funny. Might be smart to check your math too. So,
right, because they're going to overcharge you when you get to the front of the line.
Right. So it's important to know. Like one of the big things I share with my kids is, hey guys, when it says buy one get one free, there's nothing free. You know, let me show you how the math works out. And the dejected kind of looks on their faces. They're like, oh man. I'm like, no, you're buying it at a smaller price, but mm-hmm. it's not really free. You're yeah. still having to pay for something, mm-hmm. you know? Oh, that gets them every time. But it's important to kind of just, you know, again, have an awareness of the math mm-hmm. around you. And that's one of the reasons just as a consumer, why right. we should understand how the math works.
Yeah. Yes. My husband will hand me the receipt at the end of a meal because he will not calculate a tip. Mm-hmm. He just won't do it. And I told him, well, just, you know, we're just going to do 20% standard. That's just how we're going to live. Right. So let's just, you know, even just to simplify it, I was like, just move it over and double this digit. No, he will not do it. He just hands me the receipt. And so, yeah, I feel like whenever a lot of math, whenever I was young, was taught by memorization. And yeah. if it didn't make sense to me, I couldn't remember it. That was just how my brain worked. So then it didn't mean anything to me. All this, you know, father, mother, sister, I still don't remember how, I mean, I can do long division, but I can't tell you the little things that I was supposed to.
Mnemonic devices yes. and stuff that they taught yes. you or any sing songs or yes. whatever. Yeah.
I mean, songs and things I think are helpful after you understand what you're doing. But right. when you don't understand what you're doing.
Correct. You have to understand the bigger picture, you yes. know, and then, you know, then you show the shortcuts and stuff.
Yeah.
100% agree.
Yeah. Okay, great. So then that's what I would like to know is like keeping those things in mind. What does a really great math classroom look like that will help people build these things?
I love this question because it's something that in my work outside of my classroom, I'm finding that that we need to have a discussion about the difference between standards textbook and mm-hmm. curriculum. Mm-hmm. That they mm-hmm. are, I think so many times textbook is automatically curriculum, and that's right. not true. Your guideline as a teacher, your guideline and your real pacing guide is those standards. Mm-hmm. That's what needs to be taught, because then when the kids, you know, go on to the next grade mm-hmm. level, they have that foundation in, like, say, second grade. So they're ready to go on, you know, and so we could build their base knowledge. A textbook is a tool used to help teach math. But I think so many times, as I've seen it and observed myself, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but, you know, textbooks are just a tool. And mm-hmm. so the kids are just, you know, going to the next page, page 47, page 48. Sometimes that doesn't give them necessarily number sense and mm-hmm. a paint a bigger picture of the mathematics. And I've got an example to show you in a second. Whereas curriculum is using, for instance, a textbook along with all kinds of experiences, hands-on, manipulatives, games, you name it, to teach that unit, to teach that topic, standard, whatever you want to call it, kind of thing. So when you ask me what a great classroom looks like, I see, and I'm going to speak on curriculum. I mm-hmm. see curriculum being built with manipulatives, with children talking about the math, exploring the math. They're doing hands-on activities. I'm known for something called clothesline math, where the kids are constantly, you know, revising and moving numbers around. You bringing that standard of, like, or that tool of a number line to life. I see kids applying what they learned in whatever strategies to applications. For instance, three-act tasks are great visual, I call them visual performance tests, where they get one problem and, you know, get a little bit of information. And then the third act is usually, you know, the big answer, but they need to figure out what strategies to get from A to B to C. So there are lots of ways, just performance tests in general. There's so many different ways of applying what they know and putting it, their knowledge to work. So like all that is, a great math classroom should have a balance of a little bit of everything, a little bit of conceptual, direct instruction. You know, yes, it's okay to do some paperwork, but okay, give them experiences that they're going to apply their knowledge when, you know, because there's a lot of different ways to show me what you know. And sometimes mm-hmm. not all kids are test takers. So I'd rather them, you know, doing the rest of these activities, tasks, whatever you want to call them, that are going to be applicable to what we're doing and what we're teaching or learning, I should say. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think, you know. So I always think that math is about verbs. It shouldn't be a passive subject. Like I keep referring to, just, you know, turning pages in a textbook or a workbook. I think it should be about talking, about observing, about you know, making connections, about playing. I think that word is so de-emphasized when kids grow up of, no, when we play, we don't have any inhibitions. We're just, you know, we're just exploring technically. Mm-hmm. And it's, sometimes that kind of goes away. So some of the projects I do with my own students, they said, all right, what are my directions? What do I need to do? I said, just play. And they look at me like I'm crazy. But then by day three and four, it's like they get it, you know, that kind of thing. But that first day, I got to let them struggle because they're so not used to, you know, my hands are free and I'm more of a facilitator. I'm not going to tell you how to do it. You need to go explore and figure it out, kind of thing. And I think that when I do stuff like that, it takes the pressure off of trying to teach calculator kids. Mm-hmm. Those are the kids that can do the algorithms real fast and do mm-hmm. all the calculations real fast. So they think automatically they're good at math. And I said, I don't teach calculators, or I like to teach problem solvers. And so by taking, you know, some of these directions away and becoming a facilitator and saying, go ahead, guys, figure it out. they do extremely well. I think some of the ones that don't think they are as good as math as the others all of a sudden feel included. And because I believe every kid has a math idea. Every kid has a math ideas, and we need to embrace that. So all those components, I believe, make a really great math classroom.
So then in order to do this kind of teaching, what are some of the components that we need to include in our math instruction, you know, every day or every week? What are the consistent things we need to be doing?
It's hard to say like every day, because there are some things, for instance, I reference clothesline math. It's a three-dimensional number line. I tell teachers when I do trainings on it, I say, don't use it every day because the novelty wears off. I might use it every day for a unit that I teach at my grade level because it's relevant. You know, I've turned the clothesline into a ratio table, and the kids, or finding percents, like I said, and kind of like a double number line. So we're constantly bringing it out and manipulating it. So of course that makes sense. Now, do I need to do it every day if I'm a fourth grade teacher? No, not necessarily, but where it best fits. And I don't like to say, oh, do it on day two or do it, because you know your kids, you know your standards and what you're supposed to teach. So, but definitely, I think we need to be more visual. I think we need to be more kinesthetic. I think, and having the kids talk about what they're seeing and what they're observing and what questions they have. Because I believe some other math educators of mine said, if you're not able, I think it was Graham Fletcher that said, if you're not able to talk about it, they're not going to be able to write it. So, and that's an essential component when it comes to, you know, the big state tests and stuff. You're supposed to be writing about what you're observing and not just giving directions of, first I multiplied 2 times 3 and then I carried the 1 and so, you know, so on. So just like, again, a well-balanced program, a well-balanced, I go back to that word curriculum. I think, you know, but with play, with, you know, conversation, with, you know, some physical learning. And I'm not saying we need to be jumping out of our seats every single day, but when there's a time and the place, you know, that kind of thing. So that's what I see are the essential components. Yeah.
Okay. So what are some of these instructional practices that you've mentioned that we should be moving away from? You mentioned a couple of things, and then some that we should be moving toward instead.
Ah, great question. I think teachers are sometimes get frustrated with whether it be what the textbook shows them how to teach something, and they just want to jump straight to the algorithm. And I always say, you know, be patient, give time, you know, and then it, like the very last minute, here's the algorithm, here's the shortcut kind of thing. I think we need to stop telling the students what math they should be seeing, and instead give them space and a safe learning environment that they're going to tell us the math that they're seeing. So for instance, another routine I do is just like showing pictures. Sometimes they're called number talk images. And I'll just put up, imagine like, you know, a stack of sodas in boxes or whatever. So I might show that and say, you know, what do you notice? What do you wonder? And they love the notice and wonder because everybody can tell me what they're seeing. Everybody can tell me what questions they might have. And it's very inclusive. So, and you would be surprised at what they come up with. They're, you know, children are capable of such magnificent ideas, but we need to give them that space. So instead of telling them what they should be seeing, I kind of sit back and go, let me give you your space. What do you think? My quick anecdote to that is I printed up a picture, what you and I might look like as a four-leaf clover. And I showed it to a five-year-old in kindergarten because I was doing some intervention years back. And I said, you know, honey, what do you think this picture represents? And she said, 8. And I went, okay, well, explain yourself. I don't like to jump down there. No, it's 4. It's a four-leaf clover. What are you talking about? She goes, no, I see 8 halves. And I thought that it was just extraordinary for such a little person. I call them the little people down there in kindergarten, first grade. She said, no, I see 8 halves. I wouldn't have been able to see that knowledge if I hadn't shown her just something simple as that picture. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this child has some kind of knowledge, some kind of, I'm going to say, beginning understandings of fractions, which for 5 years old is pretty extraordinary. Mm-hmm. So I think giving students some space, but when you give them space, you got to give them opportunities for them to show you, show what they know, whether it be just the pictures or however assessment or activity task you have, you know, give them the space to, you know, and allow them to, you know, respond.
Yeah, I agree. That's actually very similar to the way that I taught math in my own classroom when I was a classroom teacher. Yeah. I would start out with notice and observe and what do you see? And then we would make connections back to that throughout the unit right. that we were working on. And whenever I became a coach and I tried to share certain things with teachers, just different ways of looking at things, that was absolutely baffling to so many teachers. And I wonder, part of it is, I think that they didn't understand that it's okay that not all the kids are going to say the thing that you're teaching that day. They're not all going right. to observe that, and that's okay. They all want the kids to see the answer, you know?
Correct.
And the other thing is, I think that teachers, just like in teaching writing, I see it a lot in teaching writing, because they don't consider themselves good at that, they don't go off the beaten path, and the textbook is comforting because it tells you what to do next. Mm-hmm. And so they are very uncomfortable. I can remember working with a teacher once, and I was teaching him how to represent division with manipulatives with base 10. And he said, but what do you do when you have some left over? And he goes, how do you know when you're done? Because you still have some left. I said, well, we can't divide it any further. Mm-hmm. That's the remainder. That's what remains after you're done dividing mm-hmm. as much as you these little pieces don't fit into any little group. So, you know, mm-hmm. depending on what your units are, you would have to decide to do with them, what to do with those. And he correct. Was like, oh, but it just, he goes, I tried to do it with my students, but I couldn't, we didn't know what to do. How do you know when you're done? He said he couldn't, mm-hmm. he and the kids were staring at each other, looking at these leftover units and not sure what to do with them. And because he was uncomfortable, he did try it, which I give him amazing points for that. But I, you know, because he was uncomfortable with it, I don't know how likely he would have been to do that again if he didn't have somebody to come back and say, now what do I do? You know?
Right.
And so I feel like a lot of teachers, they don't have a comfort level with math that gives them this freedom to play with it with students and still get where they're going.
That's why I'm a big proponent for having coaches in mm-hmm. the districts, in the schools, in the buildings, every district all over the United States and the states do it differently. So that's why I put a bunch of words out there, specialists, TOSAs, mm-hmm. teachers on special assignments, whatever you want to call them. Big proponent of that. And I'm surprised that, especially after the whole COVID situation, that more districts weren't seeing that, all right, kids kind of took a dip with math because, again, we weren't able to play. We weren't able right. to experience. We just did the best we could. And same with me, just did the best we could. But I missed that physical component, and mm-hmm. that was a shame. But I think when you have a coach that says that's standing side by side with you and you're learning together, hey, this really worked. You know what? We need to work on this. What do you think? And it's, you know, you have somebody that you trust and that you could process what's going on. I think you feel a little bit more comfortable about just trying. I mm-hmm. think teachers need that. Like I said, need that coach just to kind of help them out, because to try this stuff on your own could be a very daunting type of mm-hmm. experience, because you're not sure if you're doing it well. You're not sure, you know, is this the way it's supposed to go? I don't know. Great. So sometimes we kind of fall back to what we know in the routine and the textbook or, you know, whatever they do. So that's why I'm, like I said, a big proponent of just having help some way, shape yeah. or form. Maybe it's an instructional coach or whatever, but because I think then you're able to kind of push your own practices a little bit more, and you have mm-hmm. somebody side by side to kind of help you with that.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Whenever I was a teacher, I mean, obviously I do have an instructional coach, but yeah. beyond that, I also agree. Because when I was a teacher, the only reason I was able to, because my first year of teaching, I taught what I knew mm-hmm. about math, which is the way I had been taught. right? So a lot of it was very rote. And I didn't, I would try to explain certain things, but I couldn't really model it in a way that was effective. And so the reason that I was able to do differently over time is because I had support. And I had somebody who said, look, this is what it looks like when you're doing this with fractions. This is what's actually happening. Let's get off the little fraction pieces and our little fraction pies. And we're going to, you know, and by seeing this happen in real time, everything suddenly was like, and it just made sense. And after that, I completely changed the way that I taught math. Everything came together for me conceptually because I had not been taught conceptually. Everything was paper, pencil, and, you know, just do this, do this, do this. And so I feel like making that shift, I had to have another human person to help me, you know, learn as the adult. And it's okay to have to learn things as an adult because we know what we've been taught and what we've been exposed to. And it's okay to not know how things work because you just haven't, how would you know if you hadn't spent real time thinking about it? And who spends real time thinking about it when they just tell you, we'll just do this. So,
Correct.
I think we have to accept that.
Yeah. And that's why I feel like, even though I teach more of the middle grades, I'm very fluent in the K through all the way to 8 standards because I like to know where they come from versus where are they going. You know, I, like I said, in the beginning of my career, I started off with a 7th and 8th grade teacher and it was a lot more pre-algebra kind of stuff or whatever. But now I have even a greater appreciation in 6th grade, your 6th grade teacher, of where they've gone. So I'll tell, you know, some of my colleagues, kindergarten, 1st grade, wherever, this is really important. Make sure you focus on this. This is really important. Go ahead, use the 100 chart because that's going to help me, blah, 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 and so on. I've even, taken some kindergarten stuff and used it in my 6th grade classroom. And the kids are like, what? And I'm like, well, you guys are learning this. So I decided to use this routine. So it's like I said, there's a greater, bigger picture of why we all should be, you know, teaching to the standards, because I know that helps me when it comes to the middle grades. I know where they're going when they get to, you know, middle school or junior high, whatever you want to call it. Anyway, so I think it's really nice that that some people could be well-versed in the standards of where they've been versus where they're going. Yeah.
So then that actually leads me to this question about, you know, digging through all of these massive amounts of standards, because teachers have honestly more to teach in a year than they can teach in a year.
100%.
Yeah. 100%. And so sometimes you have to say, I'm going to really invest time here and I'm not going to invest as much time here because of many different reasons, right? Maybe this is something they're going to invest a whole lot of time in next year. And so I don't have to make sure they master that, or this is just introductory or whatever. So how can an instructional coach help teachers dig through these standards and curriculum, kind of like you're talking about, figure out what kinds of lessons they want to include and where to focus and where to spend their time at different levels? What could that process look like?
Well, I'm a big proponent, and I'm not saying it happens very often, but I'm a big proponent of articulation meetings, of making sure that all the grade levels are talking to each other. Of making sure like someone's looking at the standards and going, okay, let's just focus on numbers, not number sense, number systems. Is the, I was like, I know it's called NS and I'm going, okay, I'm getting all my acronyms mixed up. Let's just focus on number systems or whatever. And what does that look like in, so basically do it by domain. What does that look like in kindergarten? Was that, you know, maybe do something like that. And I always think I'm the kind of person, I like to see the bigger picture and see the whole, you know, interconnectedness of the standards versus I know. And then I figure out, okay, I need to do A, B, and C in order to get there. Some people just give me my standards. That's what I'm going to teach. But I like to kind of see, like I said previously, the vertical alignment, where they've been, where they need to go, and what's my job in this whole bigger picture kind of thing. So I'm a big proponent for articulation meetings. I think too many times though, they're not happening. And I just don't know if people know what to do. I mean, let's face it, teachers have a lot on their plates right now. There are some districts and the work that they do or the priorities that they are given is really all dependent on the higher ups, you know, people working in the district. If they're not well, I guess if math's not a part of them, all this work that we're talking about is not going to happen.
Yeah,
so it's which really, you know, like hurts my soul when I hear stuff like that. And, you know, so we hope. But yeah, articulation, the vertical alignment, I think that's the key. And just, you know, keeping up with the conversation of what works, what doesn't. Hey, I tried this routine. You guys should try it in third grade. It really, hey, you guys should, you know, and so on. So because, again, we're here to teach number sense. We're here to teach them at least some enjoyment of math kind of thing. Yeah.
So it's as part of those conversations, are you using data to help teachers drive their instruction in math? And, you know, what should coaches be thinking about as they're looking at math assessments and data with teachers?
Oh, wow. That's a humdinger of a question. And when I wish I had lightning in a bottle, but I don't. I mean, yeah, we do a lot of data collecting. I don't know how much is I'm sorry, you're gonna have to edit because I'm trying to find my words. I don't know how much time is being spent on analyzing the data. And if it is being looked at, analyzed, talked about, what's the follow through?
Totally agree.
What's the follow through that's going on? And are there any changes going on? Or, you know, like, okay, well, we didn't do so well in this, so we need to, you know, do better this year, you know, again, and it's building those experiences within the curriculum. So that's what I'm gonna think. I think the follow through or the follow up is usually what's hurting.
I totally agree. We spend time, you know, so many times schools look at numbers, at information in data form, and then teachers feel sort of awful. And then everybody goes back to their classroom and then nothing changes as a result of that. And it's kind of like, well, that was not super effective because it didn't result in any change in instruction, in classroom, in even, I mean, even at the school level, in professional development opportunities. What do our teachers need to learn to be able to do this? Because that information tells you what those kids demonstrated, you know, on that day in that format. Obviously, it's not all inclusive, but maybe the teacher needs to learn something to help the kids be able to do that in that way, in that format. So we, as coaches, we can look at that information at multiple levels in terms of what students can do and what teachers are, what their knowledge base is.
Yeah, that's been, you said the word professional development, and that's been like a trigger for me because I've been doing a lot of writing of my blog posts on my website about what is effective. You know, what are we doing when it comes to professional development? You know, and the professional development that teachers get is going to be solely based on the needs of the kids. Now, what gets lost in translation, I believe, is that we see the need and we're going, hey, we need help in A, B, and C. But then the district and the administrators might have different priorities and go, well, no, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. And you're going, well, wait a minute. So I feel like that teachers are just privy to whatever the district admin either can do or is capable of, or whatever their priority is. And I think sometimes there's a gap between what they think the priority is and what the real need is. So for instance, so when I go off and I'll provide PD, and, you know, during break time, I'll sit next to the teachers and go, so what's going on? You know, so let me get the real story so that I could plan, you know, for the next hour or whatever, like, let me listen to you because you guys are on, you know, as they say, the front lines and stuff. I want to help you, instead of just being, oh, we did math PD there. We checked it off our list, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I agree with that. We have to know when we're looking at data, for example, we have to know what it means and what we're looking at. And we need context for that. And that's why if you're not visiting classrooms as an instructional coach, I don't know how you have context for what those numbers mean, you know, right. Because there can be a lot of reasons for numbers coming out in the exact same way in different classrooms, you know, and it might be two completely different reasons. And so we have to kind of, I think that that's one thing that sometimes campus coaches are deterred from, just visiting classrooms to be part of the classroom or to see how things are going. But if you don't have context for the teaching and learning on your campus, I don't know how effective you can be in supporting teachers in thinking about their practice. Mm-hmm. You know,
exactly.
You know, on the whole scale, the school level, you know.
Correct.
So yeah, I think that that's, context is important when we're looking at assessments. I think when we look at data, we need, like you said, have an action plan of what this means for our teaching. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be realistic, and it needs to be created during that time when you looked at the data. I know I've sat in data meetings where there are actually, you know, we did like different kinds of ways of breaking down the data when I was a teacher. And then they'd say, okay, go make your plan and then like email it to us. And that didn't seem super, I mean, I had a plan, you know, and I often had looked at my data myself. It wasn't like shocking to see what information they were going to share, but many teachers needed support in making that plan and making that adjustments. Cause if they could have responded to the data in a different way, they probably would have already been doing that. And yeah. So what we can do is have people model for each other. What do you do? What does it look like? How did you do this? What is, you know, we have to collaborate around these conversations about data in order to grow everybody in the room and elevate the conversation, you know?
When we're looking at data and analyzing all these numbers, I think sometimes what gets misplaced or forgotten about is like the human factor. And that's why I don't like all this pressure with the tests. Kids are, I think, tested and assessed like way too much. Mm-hmm. Because it's unfair that one, you know, I've been reading more about like trauma and, you know, trying to learn when you've had trauma, but two, that one day that they're testing, mm-hmm. we're putting all the eggs in the basket, and maybe their grandmother passed away the night before. Maybe their mom was in the hospital. So, you know, to sit down and go, oh, look, you know, Mrs. Costa, you didn't teach percentages correct or whatever, you know, look at this kid. And I'm going, oh, you know, that human factor is what I believe some educators, and I'm just putting it a generalization, mm-hmm. sometimes forget about. Mm-hmm. So whereas I know through the various experiences that I referred to earlier in my curriculum that they did make growth. So, mm-hmm. So that's why I can't say I put all my eggs in the basket when it comes to data. It's, you know, I refer to it, of course, I refer to it, but that human factor is what's being missed. And, you know, these kids are not just a bunch of little robots that we're programming. You know, they're humans. Mm-hmm. They have feelings. They have lives. You know, things happen to them. They've probably sometimes seen or heard things and experienced things that I never experience myself, whether that be good, bad, or ugly. So I think we need to embrace, you know, the humanness of these kids versus, you know, seeing them with little scores above their heads, mm-hmm. you know, like you're proficient, you're, you know, that kind of thing. So hence, you know, it's important to look at data, but I believe we need to remember that these are little people, you know, things mm-hmm. are happening. Yeah. And the priority might not be, you know, scoring on this test, or especially the big test that we all look at. So I don't know. That's just my two cents.
I do agree. I think that a part of that is some of the data that we're looking at needs to not be just end of year cumulative, you know, these summative mm-hmm. assessments. Mm-hmm. That is not going to tell us as much as every single day. You know, mm-hmm. as the kinds of things that you can see your kids do. I think we need to look at student work together with teachers. We need to look at artifacts. Right. Actually, what did kids do whenever right. they did? What does that look like? Filling in a bubble sheet does not tell me as much as looking at something where a student wrote and drew and explained. And right. those are the kinds of pieces that we can really look at and dig in together and get an understanding of what's happening.
There's a lot of different ways to show me what you know. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different That's ways, right. and it doesn't equate to automatically a test every single time.
That's
so
right.
You know, I'm more of a proponent of the whole child, and you know, and whatever way I could, you know, like I keep referring to, building a curriculum that will give me a little bit of insight of, hey, did you, you know, pick up anything from what I just taught you with this standard? Then I'm all for it, kind of thing. But there's just a lot of different ways to show me what you know, and one test doesn't necessarily equate to what you really know.
Yes, totally agree. Well, thank you so much for being here today, Kristen. How can people learn more from you?
I have a website called kristenacosta.com. That's probably the best main way to get a hold of me. I'm on what was known as Twitter X at Kristen M. Acosta. I have an Instagram account where I put up a lot of images at Kristen Acosta Math. But mostly if you need to email me or get a hold of me or whatever, I constantly am checking my website and stuff. And that's where I get my emails from. I guess my email address is thekristenacosta@gmail.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing your expertise.
You're welcome, Chrissy. No, the pleasure has been all mine. Thank you for the invite again. I appreciate that.
All right, coach. I hope that gave you some things to think about, whether you are a math focused coach or a general instructional coach. And honestly, even if you are focused on literacy, I think it's helpful to understand what's going on in other content areas, because we can really support teachers in thinking about how literacy can be supportive of their content. Actually, that last episode I did was all about that. So you can check that out in episode 189. Remember, you can grab that Digging Into Data guide at buzzingwithlisb.com/episode190. You can also check out all the links that are there from this episode in the show notes at that link. And I would really recommend that if you're looking for a resource to help you do some of this work and talk about some of these things with your teachers, you head to buzzingwithmissb.com and you go to the shop, and then you're going to want to look for the PLC Forms Toolkit. The PLC Forms Toolkit bundle includes resources to do so many of the things that Kristen and I just spoke about, which is, you know, looking at data with some context, looking at how teachers are teaching different things, learning about your standards and unpacking them, understanding what comes before and what comes after, and looking at student work, which is probably my favorite one because I think it's so underrated and so valuable. So check out that PLC Forms Toolkit. It has agendas, it has forms and printables and guides, things you can use with your teachers to make your PLC meetings really pop if you are focusing on really any kind of learning that your teachers need to do together. Next week, we are going to start our brand new focus, and it's going to be all about school leadership. So in the next few episodes, we're going to look at how to be part of school leadership now that you are on leadership team, or even if you don't have a technical leadership team, you are a school leader, and how to work with administration in your unique role as an instructional coach. So that is going to be episode 191. And until then, happy coaching. Now that you've got so much to think about, head over to buzzingwithmissb.com to grab some free downloads, become a VIB, and check out the podcast show notes. Happy coaching!